So.
Thank you, Michael, and thank you for the invitation. And I want to thank all the previous speakers for motivating me and what I'm going to say today, particularly Jim Rice and our last speaker, and in fact encouraged me to throw in one gratuitous slide that relates to some of the other work that we're doing regarding granular materials. But I'm going to focus on fault zones today, and I just want to point out that I take the perspective of a geologist. It's very observationally based, and I try to reproduce features that we see in real faults and that we see in natural large-scale geodynamic systems, and in doing so, gain some insight into the granular mechanics that can control these systems. Even in the case where we have crustal rocks that are chock full of faults, even they can behave very much like granular materials. And in this approach, then, we can actually look inside fault zones and gain some good information about micromechanics and microstructures that develop that seem to correlate pretty well with some of the observations that we gain from the lab. But let's start big scale. Just a couple of observations. And I take a fairly simple view, and I think it's nice to come here and talk to people who have perhaps a little bit more quantitative and physical approach to describing these things. But one of the things that we've recognized for years is that granular materials can exhibit distributed or localized deformation. And the tendency for one versus the other is a function of material properties and stress history and contact behavior and so on. But persistent localization is necessary in order to get faulting, unstable seismogenic sliding. And under what conditions does this occur? And then what happens within semi-localized granular gouge zones, gouge, which is the disaggregated material that derives from the wall rocks during slip. It's a granular material, but it's on a localized scale. But even within that, we can have additional localization. And then there's been some discussion of rate and state dependent friction, where intergranular contacts would be subject to healing and weakening processes, just like those that are described in discrete rock surfaces. But there are actually some differences, and the differences are some of the things that I'm going to focus on today, that in aggregate, these granular materials show coordinated behavior that seriously affects the localization tendency. So this is the gratuitous slide motivated by the previous talk. We see discrete slip surfaces developing, but then migrating through systems as they deform. And what I'm going to show here is essentially a granular sand pile, but we use it to simulate volcanoes. And too far. And it provides remarkably good match to a lot of features that we do see in volcanic systems, including low slopes, including internal deformation, including slip planes that have the form of large landslides. But one of the things that you might have seen when this went by a little bit too fast is that these slip planes are migrating back and forth and in net are giving a fairly distributed mode of deformation. But in detail, we have individual localized planes. And so we're going to focus on those localized planes. Then these actually represent the stress field that we can quantify from this, from broad averaging of these large number of particles, about 30,000 particles in this, in their 2D discrete element simulations. This is the vertical stress, and this is the horizontal stress. But in particular, I wanted to show how topography influences the stress field, because it causes an outward tilting of the maximum compressive stress that drives slip on specific planes. And so we're talking about coaxiality. In granular materials, this does apply, but it's strongly influenced by energy dissipation and by principal stress direction. I'm actually growing this by dropping materials from above. So it's not a real volcano, it's a sand pile. And it's a quasi-static simulation. But I just wanted to show how this can relate to large-scale geodynamic systems as well. But let's focus in, because our discussion here is primarily about earthquakes and friction on faults. So this is a familiar picture to many people. Jim Dietrich was very involved in development of rate and state dependent friction theories. And this is a way for us to recognize that time and velocity strongly influence the friction acting on a fault. And the stability depends on how the friction changes with velocity. So what's shown here is a series of different experimental materials, all of which show the same general phenomenon where the change in velocity from V1 to V2, there's a direct response where V2 is an increase in velocity, a direct response, increasing friction, and that's followed by a gradual decay over some distance d sub c, in which we get another essentially steady state friction value for the new velocity. And the difference between this direct response and this evolutionary response determines the stability of the fault. So there's a number of descriptions for this. In general, they all follow this relationship where we have two parameters, A and B, which are generally empirically derived, and some base friction, which is just a reference friction, corresponds to a reference velocity and to a reference state. And when we change the friction, there's a log dependence on the ratio of the velocity and a log dependence of the evolving state. And the state is what I want to focus on here. State can be a number of different things. State can relate to contact surfaces, as Jim had described earlier. But in granular materials, it actually depends on a number of other things. And we might think of those as volumetric. Dilatancy, for example. But I'm going to argue through this talk that, in fact, there's a number of other factors that can come into play. The key here is that the difference between this A term and B term determines the stability. If A minus B is greater than zero, then that is what we call velocity strengthening. The friction at a higher velocity would be greater than that at a lower velocity, and it would seize up, and you wouldn't have runaway slip. If A minus B is less than zero, you have velocity weakening, and that's the mechanism that one would argue is responsible for earthquakes. And here's a number of laboratory experiments that I derived from Chris Marone had compiled in a summary paper. It just shows a number of aspects of this relationship. That first of all, well, start down here. First of all, with increasing velocity, we can have a decrease in friction. So that's shown in this case. Here is the same type of base friction, direct effect, evolutionary effect to a lower value. But also, if we hold the system, we stop moving the system, then in fact, over time, the contacts themselves can heal. And in so doing, the static friction upon restarting the deformation would increase. And we see this relationship, the log relationship. And here's a number of experiments that, experiment that just shows this general hold followed by a sudden start, hold, start, and so on. So the longer the hold, the higher the static friction. So again, what defines state? In this paper, 1994, Dietrich and Kilgore actually were able to characterize the increasing rate of contact area. And the red shows first measurement, and then with increasing, I have to read these numbers over here, 1 second, 100 seconds, and 10,000 seconds, you see progressively increasing area, which then is what is increasing the adhesion, the friction. And then over time, once we start to slip, there's a certain distance, d sub c, over which we have to slip to define a totally new contact population, which takes us back to our steady state condition. Now, in granular gouge, presumably these same types of features develop at interparticle contacts, but other things can come into play. For example, the distribution and magnitude of the contact forces at the contact. The number of contacts themselves will influence the contact area. And then we see that dilatancy is also very important, because what dilatancy does, if the system is dilating, then in fact it's doing work against the normal stress, and that increases the energy that must be spent. And so this proved to be a very important component. Now, the work that I'm doing is joint with Chris Marone at Penn State, and this is just an example of some of their laboratory experiments where they take granular materials and shear them in a double direct shear apparatus where this block is moved down and granular materials are here and here with a constant normal stress applied. They will undergo internal shearing and fragmentation, as you can see here, and discrete localizations do develop and zones of grain comminution. Typically, when these experiments are done, you get a bulk friction that's on the order of 0.6. And this has been observed for almost all materials and hence described by a law, Byerly's law. And then just to add to this, similar types of rate-dependent and hold experiments that Chris has carried out show that porosity also has a direct response to velocity changes. And with an increase in velocity from 1 micron per second to 10 microns per second, we see this direct effect, and then a higher friction value, so that's velocity strengthening, but correlate that with a sudden increase in porosity. So at the higher value of, at the higher sliding rate, porosity increases, the system dilates, and so that may contribute to the strengthening in here. So this is described very nicely by a relationship where either shear stress, or we'll focus on friction defined by shear stress divided by normal stress, is the sum of a base friction, which relates to the elasticity of the materials, and then the rate of change in porosity or volume. So I'm going to come back to this. And then note that in other experiments that have been conducted to very high displacements by Beeler and Tullis and others, there is evidence for a change from velocity strengthening to velocity weakening over slip. And so this suggests that the properties themselves and the aggregate behavior of the material are changing over time. So the state is changing with deformation. So we do these experiments with a discrete element method, and I think these have been described pretty well previously. And I'm using Hertzian contact law, I will point out. So it's a nonlinear contact law, but I've just using this representatively, that you have a normal force that is scaled by a normal force, which is a result of the apparent overlaps, that's the deformation of the particles, and a shear force, which is a result of the apparent shear overlap, shear displacement, and a maximum shear force, which is given by the interparticle friction. And we can just sum up all the forces that are acting at the contacts on a particle and then solve for the displacement for the net force acting on that particle. Just a couple of early experiments that we carried out because they allow us to look into the system. I use a wide variety of particle sizes here, and the reason for that is that, just as Jim Rice was describing, that's what fault materials look like. They eventually break into maybe a power law distributed arrangement of materials. The last simulation had very coarse particles. In this one, I have finer grains, and this one's rather nice because you can see discrete localization behavior here. What's shown in this plot is the slip surface at an increment of 2% strain. Over here is the horizontal displacement from which this gradient is derived to give us the slip surface. But here we're also looking at particle rolling, which is another micromechanical phenomenon that can occur in some fault materials. So I'll just step through this, and you can see that the shear zones, slip surfaces develop and then seize up, and new ones develop up and down relative to it. And in net, by 200% shear strain, going too fast, by 200% shear strain, we have overall a homogeneous distribution of deformation. So I have no contact memory at all within this system. There's no breakage, nothing. And so that is one thing we would argue is not quite right in natural materials. So, sorry. Yes, constant velocity and constant normal stress. And so the system can dilate in order to maintain that normal stress. But I'm just moving the wall in this case. Time scale in terms of relating it to geologic time scales? Yes, we're trying to match those pretty precisely. Well, unfortunately, we're still in 2D. So for the 2D experiments, they're doing 2D experiments as well. We're getting very close. We're getting similar strain rates, similar magnitudes of friction and fluctuations. I'm not actually going to show that in this, but I can show you some data later. Yes, constant stress. Say again, constant stress on the... Oh, no, I have not done that in these experiments. I have other experiments that we've tested that out, sort of putting a spring on the system. Is that what you mean? So you get a stick slip with compliant walls. Probably not what you're talking about, no, because then you would tend to get... I haven't done that. Okay. Yes, watch. Okay, so here are some of the friction plots that we get for three different experiments. This is the first one I showed you. This is the third one. I mean, the second one that I showed you. And you see, in general, the same value of friction, about 0.3, but with decreasing particle size and increasing abundance of particles, we see smaller stress drops and a smoother distribution of friction with strain. And this is beginning to look in form like the laboratory experiments, but in terms of magnitude, we still have relatively low friction values. That's primarily because of the 2D versus 3D effects. But I want to talk now a little bit about what contributes to state. And one of the things that I mentioned is force distribution. So what I will show you here is an evolving state where these particles have inner particle forces that are developing and forming networks. And in this case, they're fairly light colored because I'm going to use exactly the same color scale in all the next images. But in this case, you can see a broad distribution of forces that are acting generally in this direction. They're at about 45 degrees to the shear plane, which is typical of shearing materials. And we have zones in which we have high forces that are supported, but those don't last very long. In fact, I'll just take it back, and you can see that they evolve rather quickly through the system. In this next picture, it's a little bit easier to see them. I have coarser grains and the same normal stress acting on the system. But now, because there's fewer particles, the interparticle forces are significantly higher. But you see the same general phenomenon, except that, in fact, there seems to be a slightly higher orientation in the maximum force direction. And so just to close that very brief discussion of forces, as you adjust particle size, the mean force will vary as well. And so again, that's just a function of the number of grains over which you're distributing the stress that's acting on the wall, so the same stress. But this is important because that can also influence the area of contact, and so potentially can influence the state of the material. Yes. Yeah, actually, I haven't shown that here, except that those two plots here give a poorly sorted assemblage. And so we've also been quantifying the forces that are acting between different particle pairs. And so we have some data on that as well. It's kind of complicated to present in a short talk. So let's go back to this rate and state friction idea. In all the previous models that I showed you, I have no rate dependence on the particles. But we can introduce that. We can introduce it in a fairly simple way, and too simple, in fact, I think people would argue here. But let's just argue that the contact area is increasing as a function of log time. And I don't need a state variable at this point. I'm just going to say it's time dependent. And so in this case, interparticle friction is going to be a function of the static friction on the particle, and then some function of log time. So when the contact is static, when there's no motion, then it will follow this law, and it will progressively increase with duration of contact. As soon as the contact fails, then it will go back to that static condition. So this means that we can perhaps explore what state means within the system. And a couple of simple tests which demonstrate this. This will work. I'm sure it will work. That demonstrate what happens when you do have state variables and when you don't. Okay? I can't show you the other one, but this one will work. This one does have time-dependent contacts, and it tends to localize fairly rapidly within this internal zone. This one, if it had finished, you would see a fairly continuous arrangement of... Okay, so we have done a series of experiments, and actually I think I will go through these fairly quickly because I want to show the last result, which is the velocity stepping experiment that gives us some state information. But these are velocity stepping experiments where we take one condition that is carried out at a velocity. Initially, I start out with 1 e to the minus 3 microns per second, and then sudden increase, we see the direct effect, and then a gradual decay. But in this case, we don't have enough particles. It really gets very messy very quickly. Interestingly, we see a distinct effect on the abundance of sliding contacts within the assemblage. So that also shows a very rapid direct effect and then a gradual decay. So this is telling us something about the state. The same thing happens when we have a sudden drop in velocity, and that results in a sudden drop in the sliding contacts and then a gradual increase. The form of the friction curves also varies as a function of strain rate. This is consistent with laboratory experiments that have been carried out where at low strain rates we see a very distinct stick-slip mode with a rapid failure, and at higher strain rates we see more oscillations. Yes? In this case, the interparticle friction is 0.3. The net friction is 0.6. Yeah, in this case, it's... because I've turned off rolling. I'm sorry, I forgot to mention that. In order to get 0.6 in my 2D system. Yes, I turned off rolling here to explore the effects of sliding on the system. So in this case, I'm looking at dilation that results in the presence of sliding, because I don't get a friction value of 0.6 when I have rounded particles in a 2D system. So thanks for pointing that out. Okay, I will skip over that and mention that the experiments are beginning to capture the features that we've seen in the lab, and we see both a direct and evolutionary change in friction, fault strengthening during holds, velocity strengthening throughout. But let me just take you through this further discussion of state and dilatancy. This was, as I mentioned before, now we've done some very well-controlled experiments where, in fact, the friction is even higher here, and this is part of our parameter testing. This is just a particularly good example that I wanted to provide. Here we have one velocity, which then we see a drop in velocity at 100% shear strain, direct effect followed by a gradual adjustment to another value that is lower. So overall, this is a velocity strengthening experience. But down here is volume strain, and so corresponding with the friction change, we see contraction followed by a sudden further contraction, so a decrease in porosity as we go to lower velocities, consistent with what was seen in the lab. And in this case, very distinct force networks develop, and you can see them migrating through the system, which has been observed in the lab before. And this follows for the next 100%. So a little bit of a change that happens between that step, but it's kind of hard to see. Happy to go over this in more detail with people. Now let's try Chris Marone's hypothesis that we can simply fit the friction value to this relationship where mu is a function of this intrinsic friction and then the change in volume strain, that's what this delta is, with shear strain. Now, I've done that and I've chosen some fitting parameters, and you can see that in general, that's what the red is, that's fitting this curve. You can see in general that we're matching the form of the curve. We have the highs and the lows in about the same place. But clearly, we're not capturing both states. These parameters that I've imposed here are not going to capture this. And I haven't put in a velocity dependent of this yet, and that could be done. But I want to show you some other interesting results that do give a nice result. In this case, we have fit just the lower velocity, and again, you see the form is matched pretty well. We've got that steep drop right here, the direct effect, but in general, it's not fitting things exactly.
What do you mean by friction? I mean, you have changes of the volumetric strength, you pointed out, but the lower stress is
No, normal stress is maintained constant throughout.
You mean at the boundary? What
vertical normal stress acting on the horizontal walls is constant. So friction. No, they are a response to the normal stress being held constant. So I'm maintaining the normal stress, and the system must dilate in order to accommodate the increase in internal stress. Okay, but look what happens when we actually include another term in here, and that is a term that factors in volume itself. So not just change in volume with strain, but actually the volume itself. This is something that I had observed previously, but this actually seems to be borne out pretty well, that now we pick up a lot of the form and almost the magnitude of the friction steps, almost this step down here to with a direct effect, and we do not pick up this evolutionary effect. That's one thing I would note. But we're picking up a lot of the variations in here much better than we do before. So in fact, one could argue that volume itself is a state parameter, not just the change in volume. In some ways, I hadn't made that connection, but one could argue that. But the time, the rate dependence here is new. So I want to just open up the discussion at this point that what, in fact, would control the state in this case? Dilation rate, certainly. Intrinsic friction, certainly. But some internal property relating to contact area. But what is that and what is controlling that? It's much more complex in granular materials than it would be in rock-on-rock contact, because we're probably looking at a variety of things like interparticle force magnitudes, networks which change with shear strain and change with velocity and change with particle size distribution and particle size, fabrics associated with that. The contacts per particle, which strongly influenced by volume, and also proportion of sliding contacts, which determine how many particles are actually resisting slip as opposed to those that are sliding because of the decrease in because they have slipped recently, and so then they tend to be weak, and you tend to get localization in those zones. So there's a variety of things that we can begin to quantify with these types of experiments. And I will stop here and just open up the discussion.
Time for some questions. I want to make sure I have the sign right. You're saying that you've written it as if the volume going up increases the friction. Is that correct? Did I understand the sign? If you look at that sort of counterintuitive, I wonder if there's sort of a causality, a backwards causality in the following sense. I know if I shear a fluid at constant volume, then as I increase the shear rate, there's a normal stress that rises. And if I do the simulation as we and others have done for atomic systems, then you get dilation due to that normal stress. So,
right.
But that normal stress is somehow caused by the friction and sort of an attempt to minimize the shear stress, therefore causing it to delay. So it's more like you have more friction, therefore you get more dilation rather than you're getting more friction because it's more dilated.
Yeah, there's no question that the two go hand in hand, and it's a function of your boundary conditions. And of course, the boundary conditions I've imposed here are very restrictive, and I'm maintaining the normal stress. That's what we would do in a lab, and so that's what has motivated this. But in real materials, you can't work against the Earth as easily as you can against the laboratory apparatus. And so in that case, you will increase the normal stress as you attempt to dilate the system.
I think Peter Kundl's code has some damping in it.
Correct.
And does that contribute to the direct effects that you're getting here? In other words, what I'm trying to understand is, are you showing us a different mechanism for the direct effect than for the natural viscosity of contacts? One theory of the direct effect is that the contacts shear at a rate that depends on stress, so you increase the shear rate at contacts, you need a higher stress to do it. And then after that state evolves. But I gather that you feel you have come up with additional mechanisms that, or alternative mechanisms for the direct effect, yet the whole discussion is perhaps a little blurred because the code includes a viscosity in it. And can you comment on that?
Yeah, that's a very important point, because the viscosity is, the damping viscosity is designed to dissipate energy in the way the inelastic deformation at contacts would do. And so it is, one could say, a numerical approximation of a natural process. And so perhaps the way to explore this in more detail is to carry out more rigorous parameter tests of that particular damping phenomenon. I would argue that they're one and the same, because, again, we're trying to simulate a natural process using a simple approach, and it's velocity dependent. One could perhaps introduce force dependent damping, and that's been done in a number of codes as well. And that would introduce viscoelastic deformation associated with high forces. Well, certainly the dilatancy. And I would argue that the volume strain is, and that's the abundance of contact, essentially. But if you look at different strain rates, you now have evolving patterns of forces. And those are also going to influence how the forces are distributed. You have very high forces in one direction, very low forces in another direction. That influences how much deformation, quote, deformation can occur at an individual contact. So that can complicate the state. That's my intuition.
In some models, laboratory models of granular materials, typically people would find some direct effect, which comes from the fact that there are water bridges between, say, glass beads. I mean, is this a saturated medium that you're saying?
Yes, it's not. And in fact, when Chris Marone has shown this well also, that when you do experiments on perfectly dry quartz, you don't get this kind of rate state dependent behavior. And you have to have some effect of humidity. I don't have that. But then what I'm trying to do is approximate what they get in the lab in a, quote, humid environment. So I don't have fluids in here. Yet.
Maybe another way to ask Jim's question is the velocity dependence of your direct effect similar to the log velocity sort of laboratory direct effect, or is it maybe more linear in the velocity, or what's the velocity dependence of your direct effect?
It's a log dependence, is that what you mean?
Yeah, so is that something, it seems like that would be something that wouldn't come out of the numerical damping you have, is that true?
You say it would?
It seems like it wouldn't. If you take out, for example, the contact aging effect, and you measure some direct effect, is that maybe more linear in velocity?
Well,
than?
Independent of the aging effect, there is some velocity dependence on this in terms of steady state sliding. I haven't checked that. We hadn't done all of those tests. Yeah.
Okay, let's thank Julie again and